pulling back the curtain of silence
and learning what freedom feels like. I'm Nick.
And I'm Lala. This is Seen, Brown-Eyed Activism.
Healing at the intersections. So when we talk about white feminism and white femininity, especially in the past few years, we've been recognizing how this conversation has been dominated on social media because, like, now we can see what each other is posting.
Yeah.
It kind of bridges the gap between especially marginalized communities across the globe, but also across geographies in our little cities and stuff like that.
Yeah, suddenly we have support and we're not the only voice
just
maybe,
like,
talking back to somebody
or noticing something. Exactly. Or screaming into the ether thinking, like, nobody else gets this. I'm just all alone,
yes.
You know, which is a beautiful, awesome thing. But when we talk about these concepts like white feminism and white femininity, we've been looking at the ways that white women use their power to uphold things like anti-blackness, racism, white supremacy. And many of us know what those words mean because, like, we live with those things,
yes,
as real structures of oppression in our lives. But since they're such, like, massive constructs and concepts, I think we'd be kidding ourselves if we didn't take a step back to at least break down a little bit about, like, what are we really talking about?
Yeah, good call.
So first and foremost, it's important that we're, like, all on the same page when we're understanding what we're saying when we're talking about white femininity. Katerina Delikovsky's book, White Femininity, Race, Gender, and Power, which was written in 2010. Well, that's a long time ago, hey? Is that a long time ago? But anyways, like, she wrote a really rad book, which describes white femininity, specifically the ways that, quote, white women are coerced and compelled to demonstrate an allegiance to whiteness through their choice of intimate partners, sexual orientation, participation in racial inequality, and complicity with white feminine beauty standards, end quote. I like that a lot.
Yeah.
Like, it seems meaty and weighty enough. Would you add anything about, like, I mean, you don't have to make it as, like, academic and technical, but is there any other ways in which you would kind of add to that?
I think what I would add, and I know we're going to talk a lot more about this quote, it says a lot about the more direct ways that white women are upholding white supremacy and whether or not those white women realize it themselves. But I think something that has been a much more profound force in my life is the ways that white women uphold these structures while saying the opposite.
Like contradicting themselves.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, like, you know, in the quote, it says through their choice of intimate partners. And I think they're talking about the pressure for white women to keep the race pure, to be with white men.
Right.
Well, something that I experience is so toxic is how many white women think that fucking black and brown men makes them anti-racist, or having black and brown babies is their get out of racism free card.
Oh yes, we're gonna have, like, receipts and examples. We're gonna get into this.
Yes.
Well, we're gonna get into this.
Oh,
before
yeah.
we dive into that, like, the weeds, I think we can think of some examples of how this plays out, or how this has played out, kind of on a larger stage when it comes to, like, celebrity culture, because it's a big concept, so let's just break it down.
Yes.
So I have a top three peak white femininity.
Okay.
So
here
peak
we go.
Peak white femininity is Miley Cyrus coming at Nicki Minaj on social media and in the press after Nicki appropriately criticized the double standards benefiting white women like Taylor Swift during the 2015 Video Music Award nominations, which led to, like, the whole Miley, what's good kind of clapback that was, like, televised live, right? Do you remember that?
I absolutely remember that. And the real peak white femininity is after Nicki calls her out.
The
Miley
look
saying,
on her face.
Miley saying, oh no, Nicki, like, the media tried to pit us against each other and I really didn't mean anything. The playing innocent,
totally.
Denying what you've done.
Mm-hmm.
That's peak white femininity.
True. Facts. We see this as well. Well, we've seen this as well because I guess the show's over. I don't know. I don't follow it. But the valid criticism of Lena Dunham.
The only Lena we acknowledge is Lena Waithe.
True. Bay for life. But the other Lena, she who shall not be named Lena.
Miss Dunham.
I think she's kind of, like, the ultimate cringe queen, in my opinion. But she received a lot of criticism with respect to the way that her show Girls on HBO was casted. I mean, it's in New York. There's nary a black person. You wouldn't think that we were in New York. Maybe somewhere in Wisconsin. Like, who knows?
Mm-hmm.
And then her kind of response to that was, well, I'm trying to show life as I've experienced it. I'm like, how have you been able to dodge this many black people in your lived experience in New York? That ain't right.
Absolutely.
That's a lie. Like, yeah. Let's be honest about that. Mm-hmm. And then we see it time and time again with the entire Kardashian clan.
Yes.
Add some K's to that in the clan. From the way they style their makeup and augment their bodies to their choices of partners to their collective inability to recognize how they appropriate Black culture. And when they're criticized specifically by Black women, they're able to use their platforms and access to shut down those conversations and or turn the story into them being like vilified and harmed by Black people, by Black, like, or by people who are like giving a fuck for Black folks. You know?
Yeah, and also it needs to be said the way that they consistently portray Black people as the villains in their lives.
Yes.
So most recently, I mean, as far as I know, there's probably been more since the last time I heard, but Jordan Woods.
Yes.
Yeah. Casting this 21-year-old Black girl as being the reason why was it Chloe?
Yeah. Tristan, broke up? I was like, yo, that nigga was fucking cheating because he don't like you. And he's been cheating the whole time.
Yeah,
like,
he cheated on you while you were pregnant.
Yeah.
And he cheated on your his last partner with you while she was pregnant. Like, I don't think Jordan is the problem. This 21-year-old
girl is
the problem.
Let's do a 2 + 2 = 4 over
yeah.
here. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And like, those are the examples that I can think of in popular culture. But like you said, it's like the white women who call me girl or like, you know, talk about how this and that are so ratchet or so ghetto. And those things that they talk about that are ratchet or ghetto are usually derived from Black culture.
Of course.
The women who fetishize Black and brown men, dehumanizing them into sexual tropes and stereotypes. And then they'll feign a sense of understanding for our experiences because they fuck brown and Black men.
Mm-hmm.
It's wild. They'll date them, they'll marry them, they'll procreate with them, and then they'll also do the same thing with abysmal white men. And when you hold them to account about those conversations, about those kinds of people that they're with who are racist, bigoted, or whatever, they're like, well, that's my partner, that's not me, that's nothing to do with me. But it's like, sis, you chose him.
Yeah, that's,
you know,
your partner.
That's a person that you're willingly like cohabitating with, being intimate with, like you're literally sleeping with the white devil. And these are the, you know, these are the white women who will take up space like they own it. Mm. They will glare at Black women for being loud on trains and laughing on trains. You know that story from, like, I think this was several years ago, where it was like a crew of like Black women in their 50s, a book club on a train. They're going on a little like girls trip. They're laughing. And like, yeah, when we laugh, we happy as fuck. Sorry you don't never experience the joy of like just a gorgeous Black woman's laugh.
Yes.
But the level of criticism to the point where these women were thrown off of the freaking train because they were being, quote unquote, so disruptive.
Do you remember when I think it was within the last couple of years anyway, Solange was at a concert and was dancing and a white woman threw like her lime from her drink at her.
She threw a fruit at Solange Knowles like, you are going to
for
hell
dancing at a concert.
And it's like, where can we be? Like, if we're at a concert and you're not, you don't want me to dance? Because it's like, I get it. Some white people just can't dance. I get it. That's why you're sitting down. You just don't, you can't do it. But like, if we can do it, we're going to do it, right? And anyways, it's like time and time again, we see the same trend, the same story told the same way, which is that of like an angry Black woman clapping back at delicate white women who are afforded the opportunity to just not know the answer or not really think that hard about it or not really know that what they've done is bigoted or can be perceived as racist.
Yeah, the number of times I've been told by a white woman that I'm overthinking it.
Oh.
Right? Because they like, just have never thought about race before.
I think the crux of this is that, you know, the whole Black and brown women being so angry and delicate white women needing saving and all that kind of stuff, like, it effectively frames the conversation of white women, white femininity, white feminism, because I'm going to lump all those three things together, as a story which casts brown and Black women as angry or aggressive, which is like fucking tired. Like, let's find some new adjectives, because like, yeah, I'm angry, but like also other things.
I experienced the ubiquitous human emotion of anger that every human experiences, but I just...
Apparently it's different.
Yeah,
we experience
it.
It's
so scary.
And so, like, what I want to know is, this is how the story is told, right?
Yeah.
But I want to know, what's the rest of the story? Like, what is unseen? What's actually going on? You know, what is it in our lives that we experience on a day-to-day basis, in our daily journeys, we witness through our own eyes, that isn't that narrative of us just being angry and white women being delicate?
Yeah.
And I would like to offer, like, from my perspective anyways, and I'd love to hear from you, Paula, about when was the first time where you witnessed that trope being played out in your own life in like real time? Because I like to offer that Black and brown girls initially engage or see or encounter white femininity and white, you know, the ways in which we dote on white girls and white women in the classroom and in on playgrounds. I can recall times in my own childhood where I've witnessed a little white girl who had hurt themselves be treated very differently than myself. Or another little brown girl. And I can recall times in like high school where my behavior mirrored my peers exactly. You know, there's a teacher who's like trying to get attention from everybody and everyone's talking and like somehow my voice is, I mean, I get it, I'm loud, but like everyone's loud, everyone's doing the same thing. So suddenly when I'm singled out, I mean, I definitely got like not in school suspension, but like a detention for being like, that's racist. Cause like I just couldn't take
it. How old were you at that time?
15.
Wow.
Lala, you grew up in a really predominantly white community. Can you think of any experiences that you've had off the top of your head? And this might not be something specific, but just like,
yeah, you know. I mean, it's so, I don't know, it's so different and it's so confusing because, I mean, the first time I encountered white femininity was like the moment I was born, right? I was born to a white woman. So it was very, very confusing to be taught about being a girl or being a woman in the world by white women because they didn't understand how it was different for brown girls.
Yeah.
So I didn't have any language or awareness of that. And I certainly always felt very different growing up and felt like people treated me differently. But I really didn't know why. So my whole growing up in that really white town and in that really white family, most of it is just kind of a blurry mess of confusion and kind of pain that we're not sure why, where it's coming from.
Yeah.
So it was more in university, I think, that I start to have very specific memories because that was when I started to have people who were able to give me language and help me to understand my experiences. And then once I was able to talk about it and understand it, that's when I remember times where a white friend would say something racist and I might not even fully react. Like I might not even say anything. I might just have my face changed a little bit and have them get real defensive and be like, oh, come on. Like, I didn't mean it like that. What are you? And then it's this feeling of I've done something wrong.
Right. Fully know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Wow. I feel like I've had way more of those in my adult life than I have had in childhood, just because, like you said, it's stuff that you, through living your life as an adult, have started to connect with people who validate what you're experiencing. Yeah. And so you're not just like, oh, whoa, it was my fault. Like, I am so sensitive, for example. Like, how harmful is that shit? And like, it's difficult to move from feeling like it's just, oh, it's a perception, like I'm just seeing this wrong, to, oh, God, this is real.
Yeah.
And would you agree that like this shit is real?
It's so real. And I think it's so difficult. Like, I'm thinking of a moment in my peer supervision group that I have with other counselors. And very recently, somebody had this, she was talking about a very obvious example of racism and tokenizing. And she was coming to us saying, and she's in her, you know, mid-30s, saying, am I crazy, though? Like, maybe I, you know, and it's, she knows, she has the analysis, she's done the work, she knows, but it's still living in such a white dominated world. It is still so hard to trust yourself when you're going against the millions of voices that are drowning you out.
Totally. Yeah. And like, white femininity is the ideal, with a capital T for the and I for ideal. It is inherently more worthy. It is inherently more believable. It's inherently more trustworthy, more pure, more necessary. But simultaneously, it's required for the upholding of white supremacy. Like, you mentioned that earlier. We've seen this in like history. In the 1920s and 1930s, I watched this amazing documentary about cannabis. And they delineate kind of this path, especially it's set in the States specifically, but how jazz musicians were all smoking weed. And this was a site of creative expression. And these were like the beginning times where white women, white people, actually progressive whites, as they said, were starting to like by choice, like opt into being in black spaces, going to jazz cafes. And there was this fear there was like government ordained fear that white women hanging out with black men is like the end of all time, right? Mm-hmm. Like that can't happen because that means we're procreating little brown babies. I guess back then they would have been called mulattoes or something really derogatory. But like that was the impetus for a lot of, and then it, the story continues on talking about like the crackdown on like the war on drugs. That's how like mm-hmm. those things all come from the same history. Mm-hmm. So there's this general fear that requires white women to be with white men. That's a thing. Like white women are necessary. They're naturally complicit in the upholding of white supremacy. And the piece about the jazz is interesting because those are white women doing and trying to, you know, hang out with black people by choice. And for me, I think it's the reality of this choice that so many white women don't realize they have. Like you were mentioning this feeling or this perception that you have that like so many white women don't understand the power that they have. And yes. I think like the difficulty for me is like you have a choice. Like I see it as that you have a choice as to where you're going to, how you're going to present yourself. And your choices are always going to be inherently valued better than our choices.
Right.
You know,
I think so much of that too comes from the fact that white women occupy a very protected position.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so, but they have to work to uphold it. They have to opt into it, as everybody does. White men have to, in their own ways, they have to opt into masculinity.
Yes.
But with white women, if they play along and they express themselves in the ways that they're taught to by being sweet and nice and deferring to white men's power and all of those things, then they actually really get a lot. They get to live in some ways very protected lives.
Yeah.
Of course, that doesn't protect them from gender violence. It does. It isn't an actual liberated position, but it can be very difficult for them to give up. And I don't think they always understand. I don't know why it is. Mm-hmm. They're not really able to take responsibility for that. It's like they're so used to avoiding conflict that conflict starts to apparently feel like they will die if they get into it.
Right. Yeah. I just wanted to, because I know we talked about this previously. On your website, Skeleton Rising, you have this beautiful, I think it's called like Under Like Seeds. And I think it's beautiful. And this piece is about, I think it's titled, I Must Own My Power.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yeah.
And I'm just going to, can I say it? Or would you like to do me the honor of speaking your own words?
It and I'll just give the little preamble that the reason why I titled it, whatever it was, I Must Own My Power.
Yeah.
Is that I do think this is a bigger thing. Yeah. I think that we all have access, most of us have access to power, and so we can all learn something from this. But I wrote this while I was in conflict with a white woman, and I was experiencing her wielding her whiteness in a way that was very destructive and very harmful to me.
Mm.
And so that is why I wrote this.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, when we're feeling insecure or threatened, when we're lost in fear, pain, anger, or shame, we lose touch with our power. It is at these moments that we are most likely to revert away from our most evolved selves back to the power over tactics that reign supreme in our culture. Instead of asserting, we attack. Instead of asking for what we need, we manipulate to extract it. And when we hold privileged identities, as we grasp at power, we grab a hold of far more power than we realize. Suddenly, it is not just us in the room. We have invoked an entire system to crush the people in front of us, the people who we perceive as a threat, but who may be even more vulnerable than we are. So what I meant by this.
I love that.
Thank
like,
you.
Can I just say that's so beautifully written.
Thank you. And when, you know, we're in an interpersonal conflict and maybe the person in front of us. So maybe there's a brown woman saying, I experienced what you just did as racist.
Yeah.
And there is, for some reason, that's really hard for you to hear. Mm. The thing I think a lot of people don't realize is when you go to, you know, I think you're just being a bit sensitive. I think you misunderstood all of those types of things. It's not just you saying it, right? Because it's you and every other white person that's ever told this brown girl that she's crazy, that she doesn't know what she's talking about, that she's not as smart as you.
Right.
Right?
Yeah. Yes. And I think the beautiful thing about that, what you just read, is that it demonstrates and or illustrates that these aren't just like thoughts swirling around in our heads. Like these are what you're saying is connected to something, what a white person is saying when they are dismissing, you know, a person of color saying, okay, this is racist or that's racist or whatever. It's not just you. It's bigger than you. These things are structural. Like it's not, I think oftentimes I witness people individualizing things like, mm-hmm. Oh, well, I'm your friend. I could never do that to you. Yeah. It's not about like, I couldn't, like, you know me as a person, like, I love you. So like, how could I be racist? It's like, well, you can be a lot of things under the auspices of some structural like force. Yeah. It's not like you know what I'm trying to say?
Totally. And that's the thing, is it is a structure, and you might not have ever noticed the structure, mm-hmm. right? Because the structure is designed for you as a white person to not notice it, to mm-hmm. just think that this is the natural way that things are. It's like the air you breathe. You don't really think about, I say this all the time, you don't think about what it's like to breathe air, right?
You just do it.
Right. So you don't have to think about it.
Absolutely.
And that's the thing, is that as black and brown people, we bump up against the structure constantly, and we're forced to see it, and we're forced to learn how to navigate it. So right. I wish sometimes that these white people who think, and sometimes they'll say like, well, you're not even listening to what I'm saying. Like, you're not even taking a minute to consider what I'm saying. It's like, you don't understand that I've had this exact same interaction 50 billion times before in my life.
There's
it's
been many minutes.
Textbook.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right?
This isn't creative things you're saying to me.
Yeah.
I've heard it all before.
Like, you haven't read the textbook. You've just internalized it through the process of osmosis of
totally.
Living in a white supremacist culture. But I've
yes.
had to actually study the textbook in
yes.
order to survive.
Yes. Yes. Thank you for that. You mentioned in that piece about like the abuse of power is kind of where we kind of derail and go off.
Mm-hmm.
I know for a fact that it's possible for not just white women and white men to abuse power.
Of course.
Right? Like
yeah.
these are, so like we're talking about things that affect all of us in
yeah.
very different types of ways. 'Cause like, as women of color, we can also do harmful things that dismiss other women of color.
Yeah.
Which
or like if you ever as a cis woman of color, if you ever find yourself wanting to say to a trans woman, no, you don't understand what I was trying to say, or no, I didn't mean it like that,
yeah.
just stop
yeah.
and think about how many times you've heard that from
yes.
a white woman, right? Because you're that person. You're
wow.
like the white woman of that interaction.
Yes, thank you. That's a really good point. Let's talk a bit about how the structural power that white women possess and how it plays out in real life. First of all, I think white femininity is seen as the ideal in just the way that our bodies are treated and accepted, from our hair to our eyes to our skin to the way that we speak to our demeanor. It's not just like a preferential treatment from kids on the playground where this is manifested, you know, like take a look at the beauty industry where you have things like skin lightening, and these things like skin whitening, for an example, exists not just in the West, but also in like the quote unquote global South.
Absolutely.
In Africa, in Asia,
huge,
right?
In
so yeah, like we know for a fact that like white beauty is the standard.
Absolutely.
I talked about how we both have had our own experiences with this desiring to be seen as white or in proximity to whiteness.
Yes.
But yet, I would say, despite all, you know, the beauty industry doing what it does and all these things like skin lightening and face contouring to have white features, like a sharp bridge nose and having, you know, specific almond eyes and all that kind of shit, there is this double standard that exists when black and brown women express ourselves in our own ways. And there's also criticism when we express ourselves in ways that align to whiteness, like then you're not authentically black or brown when you
right.
do certain things. And so I would say this double standard that exists that makes us feel like we are less than, not just feel, but we are treated as less than.
Yeah.
However, when white women do the exact same things that we do, like appropriate our hair or our aesthetics or the ways we express ourselves, for example, using Ebonics or African-American vernacular,
mm-hmm.
the treatment is really different.
Yeah, if you look at the way the Kardashians
yes.
or all of the like white women rappers who steal everything from black women, right? And then they're put on this pedestal for it, like, oh, look at this incredible beauty. And it's like,
what is going on?
Like Ariana Grande trying to look like she's mixed, or
yes.
Is it blackfishing that they're calling it?
Something
people
to that
wear
effect.
The self-tanner and
yeah.
they make their Instagram, they put on the filters to make it look like they're women of color.
Yeah.
And it's like, what?
Fully. And then there's
what's
this,
happening?
There's this really interesting, I think it was like a meme or a tweet or whatever have you, but it was like white girls pretending to be gay men, pretending to be black girls.
Oh my God.
And it's like, there's
Jesus
so many
Christ.
Derivatives of like, you know, black girls will act like, you know, we'll clap shit out and be extra as fuck. And then somehow that transcends. And it's like black women and also gay black men, like gay black men are fundamental to pop culture.
Absolutely.
Right? And so I think we get so disassociated from like where it originally comes from. And I think, no, this is intentional. Like extracting pieces of people's culture and then putting it on only white bodies and making those white bodies being like the desirable bodies. Mm-hmm. That shit's intentional.
Yeah.
It's not just like happening. It's things like the way that you style yourself. It's things like, you know, when white women wear dreads versus when black women wear dreads. It's fascinating to me.
I saw someone refer to white dreads as Grinch fingers. Oh, have you ever
my
seen?
God. Yes.
That's I'm so sorry. I had that's to share so that accurate. It's so funny.
Yeah, because there's certain when you dread, the hair texture of dreads are supposed to be yeah. like, you know, woolly type hair. Yeah. Black hair is like where dreads come from.
Yes.
I appreciate people who are going to go on the internet, do their research, you know, click, 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 and be like, no, dreads existed in this place, in
but
this
they were
place.
Different.
But it's like, but they were different.
Yeah.
Right? They weren't the same thing. It's, you know.
Google is free, everybody.
Google is free. But like the idea that like white women's bodies being treated in a specific way, like, have you ever seen the ways in which black moms are vilified for breastfeeding in public places? And it is very different than when a white mom is doing the same thing. I've seen that shit.
Yeah.
Like the, ew, like, ew. Like, what the fuck are you looking at? Mm-hmm. This baby is hungry too, you mm-hmm. know? And it's shit like that that makes me, or like, man, the time I told you where I like walked out of the house without a bra on. And I have friends, I have white friends, like white, my white female friends who will do the same thing all the time. And like, I'm not trying to, I don't know what their experience is like, but I know what I've seen their experience be like when I've been with them. And it is not the attention that they garner is very different than the attention that I garner when I, like, my nipples are visible through my clothing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like the sexualization of our bodies is different than the way white women are sexualized. Like you said, inherently kind of feminine, inherently kind of like good, inherently sweet,
fragile,
you know, fragile, delicate, all these kinds of things.
Yeah.
To another point, the same energy exists within institutions, at our jobs, in our communities. Oof. You know, the ways that white feminism is perceived compared to when womanism or pro-black feminism or feminism espoused by women of color, brown women who are in the, you know, third world or global south, when we do those, when we, you know, rock our politics, we're radical, apparently. Mm-hmm. We're very radical. White women do it, take up space, and they're viewed as appropriately progressive, especially when it comes to, you know, in institutions like at workplaces and nonprofits.
Yeah, and I don't know any women of color who have worked in those kinds of spaces that haven't had horrible experiences with white women bosses mm-hmm. who exploit them, who pay them less than their white coworkers, who talk down to them, who
here in this city, like, that's random, like, yeah, I just want to like let folks know that this isn't like, this is happening in America, like, this is happening in Vancouver, BC.
Absolutely.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's also something that I really notice being a counselor. So I've noticed in my profession, white women, it's very easy for them to say that they're feminists or say that they're anti-oppressive or they're intersectional feminists and be very, very rewarded for it. Right.
Whereas it's just like when white men do it. I mean, exactly. What's the difference?
And it's really often very much paying lip service to it. Like, there's nothing about their practice or the way that they work that actually takes into account race in a real way
mm-hmm.
or other, you know, social justice principles in a real way. They're not really grappling with how they would have to do business differently in order to really live those principles.
Right. But they just say things like, I'm an intersectional feminist.
Yeah. And then they're very rewarded for it. And then for us, you know, those of us in the profession that are black and brown, I mean, we're first of all going to be seen as aggressive, hostile, having an agenda, all of those things. But we would have to do a lot more than just say it in order to reap any kind of
benefits,
recognition from that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like other institutions where we see the kind of touting of white women as being inherently, I don't even know if the word is good, because I'm referencing things like legal institutions like governments, for example. Like, take a look at the fucking heartbeat bills that are being passed in the states. Like, the people at the helm, some people at the helm are white women.
Yes.
Like, how could you do this to us? How?
Yeah.
I'm so confused. I'm at a loss for words.
53% of white women voted for Donald Trump.
I mean, and they probably will again next year.
Absolutely.
Prove me wrong, listeners. Please,
for the love of God.
Please, for the love of God, prove me wrong. But yeah, like, white women often take up space that aligns with their power, speaking over women of color, asserting their wants, needs, expectations, experiences, and then not considering the ways in which they're yielding and holding systemic oppressive as fuck power. And like kind of back to the point about women who are considered inherently militant, for example, for espousing any kind of politics that is quote unquote radical. I can think of the Women's March held in Vancouver some years ago.
Oh my God.
You know exactly what I'm going to say.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So like the type, let's just table this for a second. Like the pussy hat, like that.
Yes.
Remember that shit?
Yes.
I'm just,
oh,
I know you know, but I'm just like.
I remember it all too well.
So it's like we all have the same colored pussies. So now we all in this together.
And when I brought this up with white women who I'm actually very close to, they're kind of like, oh, come on. Like, really?
It's inherently exclusive.
Yes.
If we're not even thinking about how that.
First of all, the color. Second of all, trans women exist. And are some of the most vulnerable among us. It's not just kind of like, oh, there's this like. Trans women need to be centered. It's not just
facts.
Oh, but also trans women.
Yeah, it's not an added thing at
no,
the end. This should be at the beginning of the center of this shit.
Yes,
absolutely. But just like that entire march,
there's lots of
fuck shit that happened to that. But the type of police presence that existed at that march, I think they were like, it was negligible at best. Like there were like some cops on bikes. They were like greeting people. It was like a pleasant thing.
You could barely see them. Like there were so many people at that rally. I've been to a lot of rallies that year, and like by far the most were at the Women's March, and you could barely even see where I think there's like a cop way back there somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Like they were barely there at all.
And yet at a Black Lives Matter march, there was considerable amounts of police presence.
So many cops everywhere,
to the point where like I wouldn't be surprised if they had police in buildings just to make sure that things didn't go awry, shit, you know. And the actual organizers of BLM Vancouver are predominantly like, again, like the most marginalized people,
young black,
like, are you fucking kidding me? And so it's systemic in the ways that white women are seen as more worthy of receiving our empathy. Like you said, so many more people pulled up to the Women's March than they did to like any Black Lives Matter event. It's inherent in the ways that white women are seen as more worthy of victimhood. It's inherent in the fact that white women and white supremacy in general assumes the delinquent, the predatory in black men.
Yeah,
you know?
I think that's really important to say, because a lot of what we're talking about here is rape culture. And so much of white women's messaging around rape is just that false accusations are not a thing.
Right.
And I mean, I've engaged in that as well, because people absolutely misrepresent the likelihood of a false accusation, and people are very quick to dismiss any real cases of sexual violence.
Yes.
And false allegations are things in very specific cases, very specifically white women accusing black men.
Yes.
And this has always happened.
Exactly.
And it has continued to happen. And a lot of black men have gone to jail and have died because
Emmett Till is like a textbook example. You know what I mean? It's like white women having a choice, going out of their way.
And let's say, for people who don't know, because I mean, even when I was, I think, in university, still the story of Emmett Till was that he was a black boy who had whistled at a white woman and was
about 14 years old,
yeah,
lynched because of that.
And then in the last couple of years, what came out is not, I mean, that's horrific enough.
Mm-hmm.
What came out in the last couple of years is that the white woman lied about
She admitted
that.
To lying.
So he didn't even whistle at her.
Yep.
She just lied and got that boy tortured and murdered.
And he was brutalized beyond recognition.
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't, you know what I mean? It's like the dehumanization of black men is something that we have to talk about when we're talking about white feminism, white femininity. Mm-hmm. It's not enough to be like, black men desire me, therefore I'm not racist. It's like, look at that example where it's like a black man supposedly desired her, and look what that caused. That wasn't even real.
And
you know?
Exactly. And then in the modern day, I mean, there's still very real violence going on a different end of the spectrum. Do you remember a few years ago Lena Dunham talking about sitting next to Odell Beckham Jr.?
Oh yeah, at some sort of
whatever,
like dinner.
And she was saying that he was ignoring her because he saw her as not fuckable enough, and so she could see him looking at her in this dehumanizing way of like, oh, I can't fuck it, so I won't, you know, I
engage
won't even
with
engage.
It. Like, I mean,
and
so
he came out to say, excuse me, like that it was all in your head.
Exactly.
Like, what do you mean? That entitlement. And it's so interesting where the switch happens. Because on one hand, it's this entitlement that so many white women have. Black men should desire me.
Mm-hmm.
I should be seen as, you know, more the most beautiful by black men.
Right.
And then it switches into this, oh, you dehumanize me and I'm this victim because you didn't fulfill
you're hypersexual
my
and you
expectations
are.
Of,
absolutely.
Yes.
Yeah, that was a really shameful thing that had happened. And I was so pleasantly surprised at how he had clapped back and was like,
yeah.
So black men's existence isn't just for white women to fuck them.
Yes.
P.S.
Yeah.
It's not about like some Pornhub fucking reference that you're trying to make all the time.
Yeah.
So many of us joke about the fragile male ego.
Yeah.
But I'm also interested in discussing the fragile white woman psyche.
Mm.
Because I would say white women, when held to account, and we've talked about this before, are always seen as in need of protection from black and brown women. Like, mm-hmm. if we come for them, it's like, oh my God, somebody needs to pull up on, like, this is stressing
yeah.
me out.
Or
what are we gonna do?
After white women helped elect Trump, then it's suddenly like, oh, we need black women to save us, and oh, black women will lead the way. But of course, not by actually giving money to black women. It's by just asking black women to do all of the organizing work for you.
Yeah.
Do all of the work for free, right? It's never in a way that's compensated.
Oh, totally. And like you said, like white women and white femininity is always espoused by women who are inherently non-critical, which is...
Well, and sadly, also white women who try to be critical. It's just, it's so insidious.
Mm. And I feel like the ultimate peak non-critical feminism is this like girl power sort of rhetoric that gets smushed around everywhere, which is like cute in theory, but it is so... It erases so much about what are we talking about when we say things like girl power.
Yeah, because what needs to be said that is very rarely said by white women, gender is a racial category.
Mm-hmm. Oh my God, yes. What's that quote? All the women are white and all the blacks are men.
Yeah.
There's difference in these groups. Like, you got to think about it.
There isn't really a social category of woman, really.
Yeah.
The gender, so we look at even the way gender is constructed. So the stereotype of white women is that they are fragile, passive, delicate, sweet, all of these things.
Mm-hmm.
The stereotype of black women is that they are aggressive, masculine, loud, you know, all of
yeah.
these things,
yeah.
strong.
Yeah.
Right? It's gender is inherently raced. You
yes.
can't separate those things. And so trying to unite us under this banner of woman and not pay attention to race, it just doesn't work.
Mm-hmm. And for me, what gets me the most fucked up is like white women's inability to recognize, like we talked about owning your power, to recognize that they have the power. Like that, to me, I'm like, get the fuck out of my face. If you won't even entertain the fact that you have one iota or one little, just one little speck of power. Because that's a false lie that you're living if you think you have zero amounts of it, if
yeah.
you're a white woman.
And I think what's really, I mean, there's so many things that are dangerous about it, like we talked about earlier. But I also think if you're a white woman who really cares about social justice, you should be thinking about your power all the time because you need to be leveraging that in
mm-hmm.
service of justice and liberation.
Yeah.
So if you're not aware of how powerful you are, then how can you be using your power to bring others up? You can't be, right?
Yeah.
So you should be engaging with your power every single day to use it for the greater good.
Yeah, I would agree. And go further to say, like, you know, another problem with girl power is that it doesn't solve the problem. Like, we've talked about girl power for forever. Have we cracked the code on misogyny and all the things that affect blanket term women? No.
Mm-hmm.
Girl power hasn't been the trick. So there's got to be something else that we're like white women are willing to take a crack at,
yes.
which is that owning of their power.
Yes.
And also recognizing that like we need white women to like show the fuck up. You
Absolutely.
Know what I mean? Like our safety depends on that. Our community building and organizing depends on that. Like
yes.
our ability to survive
yeah.
as brown and black women actually depends on white women like getting in the car and doing the thing and like giving a fuck.
Yeah.
We can't do this shit on our own.
People. And absolutely,
yeah.
all of these things.
Yes, totally. Okay.
But we don't want to just talk about white women.
No.
We don't want to talk about what they have to do because that's not our work, thank God.
No, it is.
So we really wanted to have a conversation about us as Black and brown women. What is helpful for us in surviving this? What is helpful for us in dealing with this dynamic that we have to live with every day?
Yeah. And like, to your point, like, I don't think it's helpful for people of color to have to go do research on like white supremacy and white feminism, white femininity. I don't think, like, I think we know. I think we've got it. You know what I'm saying? I think that's for white folks to figure out. One of the things that in terms of like taking care of myself, mm-hmm. and it's like, how do you get yourself out of bed and like live in like a white supremacist capitalist world that like inherently doesn't value you, right? I don't know. For me, I've just like divested so hard out of representations of whiteness.
Yes.
Like, I don't try to consume any social media that is predominantly centered by white people. I just am like, no, this isn't for me. Like, mm-hmm. It's not because I'm like, I can't find anything in this that I would enjoy. That's not the case. But it's also
your
like
quota, probably, right?
It's like I go to work. I've already done that. Like, I step out of my house. I already am in existence, coexistence with a lot of white people. I've spent a lot of time with white people in my life. My partner's white, right? Like, and I love him and I like love his family. But like, am I also simultaneously in love with being a person of color and being Black? Fuck yeah, I am. So I just like, for me, it's been an intentional pouring into creators who are of color.
Yeah, because the thing for me is the media, especially growing up when we didn't have as much power to opt in or out of media, everything was white. Everything. So I have heard 80 billion white stories already. And so often, you know, white people get offended if you say you don't want to engage with white media because it's like, oh, well, we're all human and you should be able to have empathy and the racism. It's like, yeah, I do. I've spent my entire life empathizing with white people, like watching white stories and empathizing with them and finding the human in it, right? Mm. I'm bored. It's been enough time. I've spent enough years of my life doing that. I want to see something different. I want to see different stories. I want to see people on screen that I've never seen before. And I want you to find the humanity in our stories and empathize with us. But if you're not going to, I'll do it for myself.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. Like, I constantly, especially on things like Netflix, where you're like, do I need to watch another movie with the cast is all white, save for one racially ambiguous person? Yeah. Like, do I need to do that? And like, it's a choice, right? Like, I can make that choice. And oftentimes I opt out because I'm like, no, I'm passing on that. I don't think this is going to do anything for me.
Yeah.
What it does for other people is up to them. But
and we have so many options now.
Yeah. And can you speak a little bit? I know we talked about your kind of divesting from whiteness and the intentional work that you are thinking about or that you are doing with respect to like finding service providers, for example, that are people of color.
Yeah. So it's been really important to me to try to support people of color and surround myself with people of color as much as possible.
Yeah.
And again, especially growing up the way I did and especially living in a very white city like Vancouver, it is very, you have to do it very intentionally or it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
So I spend a lot of time building this, and now I've found, you know, my doctor is a woman of color. I saw a naturopath who's a woman of color. I have an RMT who's a woman of color. My therapist is a woman of color. My hairstylist is a woman of color.
Yeah.
It's just all women of color all the time. And I really want to support those businesses. As a therapist, for 99% of the time, I will refer to other therapists of color.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very intentional surrounding myself with other people like me and supporting other people like me who are trying to do something different.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I think surrounding myself or even like surrounding myself with other women of color, consuming media by other women of color.
Yes. I actually made a rule a while ago that I wouldn't watch anything that had less than like 90% people of color.
Mm-hmm.
And I also try to pay attention to especially to who's writing it.
Right.
Because that is real key. Because sometimes you're watching something and it is all Black or brown people on the screen and you're like, this just feels like it's for white people or it doesn't feel authentic. And then you look at who wrote it, you're like, oh, I see what's happening.
Knew that.
Yeah. But it was actually really helpful for me because to have a rule like that for at least for a while, because so much of media is white, yeah. or is, you know, people will think if there is 20% people of color on screen, people think that's lots.
Right.
And like, I've had people be like, no, you like this. It's lots. There's lots of people of color in it. And I look it up. I'm like, are you serious?
Oh, God.
Come on.
And then it, like on the other end of the spectrum, it's like when there is an all black cast about like people are like, well, where are all the white people, though? Like, what? I don't understand. Like, why is the white person just the one friend? Like, why?
And you don't like Kate Walsh and Girls Trip?
Yes. That's exactly what I was thinking of. Like, that's exactly what I was thinking of. I know. It was perfect. It was perfect.
But yeah, we have so much, like, I'm like, why do I need to watch Girls when I could watch Insecure?
Mm-hmm. I mean, right? Actually, though, it's a bolt, like a very
a way
like,
better show, yeah, in so many ways. But I mean, there's so many, like, I'm Queen Sugar and Pose and Greenleaf and The Chai.
Yeah.
And like, there's so many options now, and it's like, I feel like there's so many shows in so little time, and there's so many characters on these shows that I've never seen on screen before.
Yeah, that's the beautiful thing. It's like, for me anyways, it always took a while to wrap my head around like the things that I could be, because I never saw representations of those things. And now, like, because we have this beautiful thing called like social media, and we have beautiful, brilliant creators of color who are emerging out of everywhere doing what they do so well, it's just been able to give us like more opportunities to dream for ourselves. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely. And to see people who experience the world in more similar ways to us, right? And to see it on screen, and to know that, I mean, Insecure is so good for that too, like to know, oh, that's not just me that's felt that way.
Yes.
Right?
Totally. That's a really good segue, because we're going to do our Woman of Color of the Week.
Yes.
And she's one of the stars of Insecure. Her name is Amanda Seales. I've talked about her at length many times, but this is a dedicated Woman of Color of the Week.
Yes.
In part because, like, she's a brilliant comedian, a brilliant actress. She was a DJ. She sang. She was like on My Brother and Me on Nickelodeon. Like, she's just like done all the things. But one of the reasons that I love her is she has spent a considerable amount of time creating Smart Funny and Black, which is like a live show that celebrates and educates Black folks specifically on Black culture, which I'm dying to go to. She has no shows in Canada, which sucks. So I have to go down south of the border in Trump's America.
She also won't send merch to Canada.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, you tried. You. Oh my God, you love me so much. Yeah. I have a P.O. box in Washington State, so I will definitely order. Yeah, yeah. Okay. I didn't even know. My sister does, so I'm like, I'm going to use it.
Awesome. Okay.
But like, one of the reasons why I think she's such an important person to highlight for this episode is she has this beautiful distinction in her stand-up comedy special called I Be Knowin'. It's on HBO. Watch that shit. It's fucking hilarious. But she talks about, in either her stand-up or her podcast Small Doses, about the difference between and discerning the difference between white women and women who happen to be white. And when I first floated this with you, Lala, you were like, I don't know how I feel about this. And I was like, no, let me explain what she means, because it can sound like the opposite. So white women are the types of people who, like we said, are oblivious to their power, or they might actually really believe that they are superior to other people because they are white. Women who happen to be white are the women who are actively trying to use their power and privilege to create opportunities for people of color, yield space to people of color, and who are actively trying to unlearn the things that white supremacy has taught them. And so she kind of provides, I would like to say that she's like one of those new thinkers out there. She drops a lot of amazing gems on her Instagram stories. I'd advise you follow her, because she's just brilliant.
She is.
And really funny and really refreshing. But an amazing thing about her is that she takes a lot of time to express her thoughts on white folks who come at her. And like, she freely posts, like, when somebody is like, you know, not all white women, she'll just like take a screenshot of her reply that'll be like, get the fuck out of my fucking like DMs, this isn't about you, blocked. Like, and it's that kind of fearlessness and commitment to centering Black voices and not allowing white folks and white women specifically to derail conversations about what we're actually talking about when white women feel uncomfortable that I really love about her.
That's such an important boundary to have, to be able to just know what's true for you and not entertain anything else, to just say, no, I'm not doing this with you.
No.
And I don't have to.
No.
And to like live in that power that I don't have to do this with you.
Absolutely. And I think like so many of us can take a page out of that book, you know, myself included. I know that I have had experiences where I feel it's different because she's a celebrity, and so people feel like they have the ability to access her, or at least talk at her, or comment in her DMs, or comment on her posts like she's not real, because she'll always respond and be like, hey, I actually read this shit. It's not this isn't a discussion forum. Like, this is my actual Instagram page. I'm an actual black woman. So yeah. Like, actually don't do this shit. Like, go somewhere else. Like, create a Reddit thread, go on Twitter, something else. But in my own life, I think I need to set up stronger boundaries when it comes to engaging in those kinds of conversations that are fruitless, because they're the same conversations we've been having for forever. And it's like, Google is free, you know?
Absolutely. You know what you said to me, though? I was struggling with this a bit, that there were still people that I worked with specifically that were just saying things that were so racist, and it was so hard for me to respond. And I would try to respond, and then just their reactions to me would be so hurtful. Mm. And you said something about, like, you say what you want to say, and then you just keep it moving, like you don't even wait for the response.
Yeah.
And I think about that all the time, because I think, again, it's that same energy of knowing what's true for you and knowing what your boundaries are, like knowing what feels useful to you.
Yes.
Or enriching to you in some way.
Yeah.
And anything else, just saying absolutely not, and not even worrying about the way that affects that person, because that,
that's,
you know,
them.
That's them. That's their work. I have more than enough of my own work
absolutely.
To do.
Absolutely. Yes. I say some shit that I forget all the time, and you always be like, you said this one thing to me, and I'm like, did I? That, yeah. I did. I did say that. But it's true. I think, like, those are the choices that we can make for ourselves, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we can, and it's difficult in workplaces because you inevitably have to spend time with those people. There are ways that subtly that we can establish our boundaries and show people how we want to be treated. Unfortunately, most people don't respect those things, but when given the opportunity, sis, take that shit. Like, take the opportunity to be like, I will not, and I will, and this, that, you know?
Yeah. Like, so what I'm taking from this episode today is standing in our truth.
Yeah.
Finding each other.
Yes.
And really focusing on each other.
Yes. Spending time searching and seeking out each other. Mm-hmm. Like, I think for me, that's the biggest antidote that I can think of to this fucked up thing called white supremacy and white feminism, white femininity. It's like, all I know for sure, what Oprah says, what I know for sure is that we're all we've got.
Yeah.
Right. And so when we don't look out for each other, and at least when we don't spend time looking into each other's eyes and saying, like, I saw that.
Yeah.
When you see it.
Yeah.
See it and say something.
Yeah.
You know, because that just affirms somebody's inner voice telling them that they are, like, you know, on one. And we don't need to do any more gaslighting of ourselves.
Totally.
Because white women are going to do those things for us. And I think, like you said, finding each other.
Yeah, finding the spaces where it's just us, creating the spaces where it's just us, because we sometimes we don't even realize how much editing we're doing or just how much.
I'm so happy you said that. Yes.
Yeah, how much work we're doing to sort of
keep it all together.
Yeah, to maintain our sense of reality when we're being gaslit. We do it all the time, and sometimes we don't realize just how much it affects us or what else is possible.
Right.
Which is why I think it, for me, it has been so life-changing, honestly, to seek out and build spaces where it is just us, mm-hmm. and we don't have to entertain any of those perspectives. Mm-hmm. The distance that we can go when we're not having to stay at that level of justifying our reality.
Getting goosebumps.
Ooh.
Yes.
Yeah,
and that's that on that. That's that on that.